All right, thanks. Yeah, that works. So I should say, in the past, I have done work that's sort of more relevant to the main topics of the workshop, which I think is why I'm here. But, and I could have talked about that, but I will be frank, and I haven't been working on granular materials or sort of friction-related things over the last couple of years. And sort of in the spirit of a workshop, I thought it would be useful for me to just tell you what I am really excited about. And so that's the point here. So it may just be purely cultural, but this work is in a stage where I think it would be really useful for me to, you know, sort of share with you what I've been able to do, and maybe it could go somewhere even farther than where it's gone. And so the basic idea is to relate what we call complexity, I think physicists and geologists and have a very similar view of what we mean by complexity, which is, well, we know it when we see it, and if we don't understand it, it must be complex, to what computer scientists call complexity. In there, it's actually a very well-defined concept for which they get very annoyed at the physicists, of course. And so I have it there. And basically, it turns out that I think the problems have really deep and interesting relations, and that because of this language thing, for, you know, the computer scientists at step one are annoyed by our loose nomenclature, means that I don't think that there has been sufficient appreciation of what they have to tell us or what we have to tell them. So what computational complexity is what you do is you have a problem, okay? And again, everything is well defined because they view themselves as mathematicians, and none of them, as far as I can tell, actually know how to boot a computer. I seem to know much more about, you know, how do you get your thing running again after the core dumps than they do. But that's because in their hearts they're mathematicians. And so they say, well, there's a problem specification. And what you mean by resources here is that you say, how many bits does it require to, you know, give the information it needs to specify the problem? And how many computational steps does it take to solve a particular problem? Okay, and what happens, one of the things they do is that they classify problems into different complexity classes, which is sort of, you know, how the time scales as the size of the problem specification increases. So what does this have to do with us, as you might say? So again, what we call complex systems are just, you know, problems that are hard to solve. So the first one is that my background very much is in the dynamical systems community, trying to understand, make statements about the dynamical behavior of complex of nonlinear equations and particular things that might be chaotic, et cetera. So basically you say, well, but that's a problem. It's a perfectly well-defined computational problem. And so you can ask the same questions that a computer scientist might ask about, well, how do the resources scale that you might need to solve the problem? And then the other thing is just that the computer itself is a dynamical system. And so sort of this idea of, you know, you have some input, this would be program if it was a computer problem or an output. But a dynamical system, you have the initial condition, and then you have an evolution, and then you have a final state. And you might want to say, well, you know, what does it take to get to the final state? So that's like at the level of boxes and arrows and not so useful. But I guess over the last 6 months or a year or something, I've been trying to see what things that they know would help are relevant to us and vice versa. And so the two things where I've been working on this one I'm not going to talk about. This is trying to use physics insights to get some understanding into the P versus NP question. And if anyone has interest, I'm happy to bend your ear about that. But I'm not going to talk about that. Because I think from our point of view, I think it's useful to think about the concepts that they've come up with and how maybe they have something to say about physics. The thing I'm going to tell you about is the concept of an interactive proof and the implications of some results from the study of interactive proofs for dynamical systems at exponentially long times. Okay. All right. So I'm just going to tell you things you already know at this point. All right, so the thing is that if you think about a chaotic dynamical system, at least for me, there wasn't really any fundamental difference between a discrete system and a continuous system. And I should say that when I talk about discrete and continuous, I'm talking about the spatial variable, because you can always like take a time slice and, you know, turn a continuous time dynamical system into a discrete time dynamical system, and Poincaré did it in 1902 or whenever it was. But what I'm talking about is sort of the space. So I'm taking the slices in time and then asking the question of, can we predict the spatial structure a given time later? And we hardly ever think about exponentially long times. But basically because in the long run we're all dead. But computer scientists don't care about that, right? Because they're mathematicians at heart, so they don't care whether we're alive or dead. They just want to know what's true in a mathematical sense. And so this is the thing that mathematicians would think about. All right. So now this is the physicist's point of view. Is that it doesn't matter whether it's discrete or continuous. If it's chaotic, then nearby orbits diverge exponentially in time. And so if I convert that to bits, it means that the number of bits I need to describe the state of the system is growing linearly in time, just because that's the way bits are, you know, log 2 bits, you know, et cetera. Okay, and that statement is true both for continuous and discrete dynamical system, all right? And so up until I got into this, I never really thought there was anything seriously different between a continuous and a discrete dynamical system. But what happens in computational complexity theory, in a very well-defined way, there is a fundamental difference between continuous and discrete dynamical systems. Discrete with many degrees of freedom and continuous where, you know, you can infinitely divide up space. And again, we never ask about this question just because, again, and what I mean by exponentially, again, is a function of system science. But exponentials blow up very fast. And this is like my favorite little thing, is that n of 150 is not a very big number, but if you take the exponential of 150, it is a big number. And so if 10 to the minus 12 is, it was like a number chosen to be faster than any computer that exists. And, you know, so again, you know, we may not care because we will be dead, but still you can ask yourself, you know, what about, you know, could you in principle predict what happens at exponentially long time? And the result is that the theory of interactive proofs tells you that in principle you can. Okay, and that's what I'm going to tell you about. All right, so, and I did this just because I had too much time on my hands, and PowerPoint does this to people. All right, so, you know, this is this thing about how the orbits diverge, and then, you know, you could imagine you did this too when when you were on a plane and things were slow, and, you know, so here it is that starts off here, and then this is the famous logistic map. I'm showing the divergence of the orbits, and then that's the first step, and then after you iterate the map, then these guys are farther apart. And then you iterate the map again, and now they're even farther apart. And that's just to show you that the orbits are diverging exponentially in time. And again, that was just because I had too much time on my hands. Okay, so that was a continuous dynamical system. So again, you can just think of logistic map, all right? Now, the discrete dynamical system, which I keep in mind, and now again, this is me. I mean, computer scientists really don't care. You know, they don't really care what specific system you have in mind because that's not the way they think. But I have to think this way, so I'm doing it for you. So just to give you something in mind, there's a well-known model called the NK model, where it's useful to think about, where basically each one of these guys is a variable which you can call sigma, and so each one of these guys is either 0 or 1, and whether it's 0 or 1, it depends on what the value of its inputs were at the previous time step, and then you just pick a random function and says, well, if the function was 0, 0, 0, then at the next time step, this guy is 1. And, you know, again, picking a lot of random numbers, you can specify random dynamics. All right. And the thing about this model is it's very simple to define. It's very, very nice because there are a lot of things you can say about it because everything's completely random, so you can characterize it probabilistically. And then the other thing is because the variables at time t plus 1 depend only what happened at time t before, and every guy has a finite number of inputs, and there are only n of them, you can do it all in polynomial space, right? You just have to keep what happened at the previous time step, and you can go on. And so a computer scientist would say, you know, any schmuck could see that this is a problem in p space, which is, again, it can be computed in polynomial space. Again, it doesn't matter how many configurations you have, right? You just go, and you never need to keep it's a one time step back. And so you can compute for exponentially long times in polynomial space. So space is more powerful than time because you can reuse space. And the result that I want to, you know, that to me strikes me as interesting is that in the 90s, it was proven that Any question that you can ask about a Boolean net can be verified in polynomial time. Okay, so to me this is completely bizarre, but this is the result. That, you know, you have this system and you'd say, well, everything's completely random and you made it up from scratch and we're gonna do this for exponentially long times. How can we possibly predict what's gonna happen at exponentially long times? And the answer is, no problem. Okay, and fortunately for you, I suppose, unless you're interested, in which case you can come talk to me, you know, it takes more than 5 minutes to explain to you why that is true. But I think that's sort of remarkable, right? That a totally chaotic dynamical system with everything utterly random, in some sense, is polynomially predictable. You know, it's not a polynomially bounded computational agent cannot predict what's going to happen, but if someone told them, I said, I can do it, all right, then you can tell for sure whether or not they told you the right answer, even if you're polynomially bounded. So that's the result. And I think it has, and I should say, first of all, that I found it remarkable, but fortunately, the computer scientists were also like blown away by this. But then the other thing about it is it's not true in the continuous space. The reason I did that stupid thing with the logistic map is that it's absolutely true that you need all those bits, because at every time step you need more bits. You can prove that absolutely analytically that you need exponentially many bits to do the prediction for the logistic map. And for that Kaufman net, you don't. Okay, so that's the result. So now who's doing the time? You're doing the time. So basically the way this talk works is just tell me when I have 3 minutes and then I will, how much time do I have? Oh, 17 minutes. Okay, so I can actually tell you something. Okay, about what they did. Everything I'm gonna tell you now is, not my work. Because, you know, I'm sort of like, I think this is cool and you're having to listen to it for half an hour. Okay, so the thing is that I'm going to tell you about, again, stuff that every computer scientist knows, and basically about probably in the late 80s, this concept of the interactive proof came up, and again, as a physicist, it's really tantalizing. Okay, so the picture is you have some incredibly powerful computational agent called the prover. And in physics, we like to think of the prover as nature, that we're asking nature questions, and nature is slightly dishonest, but, knows everything, but not necessarily honest and perfectly capable of misleading you, okay? So that's prover, and we're the stupid verifiers, okay? And so these things are also known as Arthur-Merlin games, and we're Arthur and Merlin. Merlin's the wizard, and Arthur is sort of the very computationally limited guy. Okay, so anyway, so it's a protocol where you have, again, this prover who in principle knows everything that you want to know, and the verifier who's like, well, the prover may know, but the prover may also be lying, and so how do I know that the prover is telling me the truth, okay? And so the idea is that the prover tries to convince the verifier that something is true. And the verifier basically trusts but verifies. The aged people in the audience will know what that's referring to. And basically says, comes up with a bunch of questions that the prover will answer correctly, only if the thing is actually true. Okay, and the question is, and the verifier always is convinced if the statement's true and is hardly ever fooled if the statement is false. And it turns out that hardly ever being fooled is not a problem, because what you can do is you can just run it a lot of times, and, even if the prover's only off, some reasonably small fraction of the time, if you do enough trials, then, you'll know for sure. So you just do a bunch of trials, and if the prover isn't right, that the prover was lying to you. And this was developed as a generalization of NP. Oh, and I forgot to say what NP was on here. It's called non-deterministic polynomial. So, you've heard of P, and those are things you can solve in polynomial time. Non-deterministic polynomial means if somebody gives you the answer, you can verify it's the answer in polynomial time, but you don't necessarily know how to find the answer in polynomial time. Okay, so IP is interactive proof, and naturally P stands for something else, but that's not my problem, that's their problem. And so the point about NP is you can interpret it this way, where, you have, again, some all-powerful computational agent that is telling you, that tells you the answer. And then, you're limited, but you can check it in polynomial time, right? And so then the idea is that, well, not only can the prover give you the answer, but I can ask the prover a question. Okay, and it turns out that there's one other thing that's vital for the power of interactive proofs, is that you're also the stupid computational agent is also allowed to flip random coins. Okay, and do something with, you know, flip a coin where the all-powerful prover cannot predict the value of the coin. Okay? And so what happened was when these were developed, no one really thought that much of it because they said, well, you know, you maybe could do a little more, but you really couldn't do a lot more. And so what? All right? This is also a well-known question in computer science, so what? And basically they said, well, but the verifier is polynomial bounded. So, you know, what? So how? What could this possibly gain you to be able to ask questions? And it turns out that you gain an enormous amount. And so what I'm going to do is, this is, again, historical, but just to give you an idea. This is the first problem. And this actually was like 5 or 6 years after interactive proofs were sort of written down. This was the problem that sort of that sort of galvanized people into thinking that they might be interesting. Okay, so first I have to tell you what graph isomorphism is. And if you know what graph isomorphism is, then you can just sort of fall asleep for a second. All right, so what happens here is a graph is a set of vertices and edges, okay? And so, you know, here I've got A, B, C, D, E, well, actually I have A, B, C, D, G, H. I stole this, so don't blame me. And then here's 1, 2, 3, 4. This one actually has all the things. Anyway, the point is that A is connected to H and I and G, et cetera, et cetera. And the question is there a relabeling of the vertices that converts this graph to that graph? And for this, the answer is yes. That if I like, so if I use this mapping, which is relating A through J to 1 through 8, then it turns out that I can convert this map to that map, that those connections are the same and the vertices are the same. All right, and so the thing about it is that if you give me the mapping, I can check it, all right? And I just check it, I see if it's true, I just count whether the right things are connected to the right things, and it takes polynomial time, and so graph isomorphism problem is an NP, non-deterministic polynomial time. But however, no polynomial time algorithm for graph isomorphism is done, all right? So in other words, if you tell me the answer, I could verify it, but I don't know how to, derive it. Okay. Now, that's just a well-known problem. But it turns out that the problem that sort of got everything going was the study of graph non-isomorphism. Okay. And what graph non-isomorphism is you give me two graphs, and it's a statement that the graphs are non-isomorphic, okay? And so the point here is that the problems that are, this a problem which is sort of the complement of a problem in NP is called co-NP. And they're harder than NP in the sense that, you know, if someone gives me the answer, I can verify it, you know, I can verify that they're isomorphic because you give me one isomorphism and it works. But how do I know that they don't work, right? You can't. It's not an NP because I don't know how to do this, right? Now that statement is not proven because of various things about computer science, but intuitively that's sort of the idea. Okay, so graph non-isomorphism is in some sense harder than graph isomorphism because you have to show that no isomorphism, or, you know, no mapping works. None of them work out. And so basically the first sign that interactive proofs could do more than just NP was the proof for interactive proof for graph non-isomorphism, right? And again, this is like 5 years after interactive proofs, and then all of a sudden everybody got all excited. So here's the proof, and not only that, so you can fit it on one side. It legitimately fits on one side. Okay, so basically you say, well, all right, I've got two graphs, A and B, and I don't know if they're isomorphic, but the prover says I guarantee you those graphs are not isomorphic. Okay, and you're like, all right, we'll prove it. All right, and so what you do is, again, and there's no way of, you know, he can't give you an instance of a non-isomorphism, right? Because it doesn't tell you anything. But what he says is, okay, you pick one of your graphs and you make up an isomorphism and you send me the graph. Okay, and so let's say I have graph A and I sort of permute the vertices and I send it to the prover, and then the prover says, oh, well, that one's isomorphic to A. Right? Now, if A and B are isomorphic graphs, and this is the math which is not on the slide, then it turns out that, you know, it's isomorphic to A, but it's also isomorphic to B, and these authors prove that, you know, with equal probability he'll give you the, you know, he'll pick one or the other. Is the graph isomorphic? So if the prover tells you that the graphs are not isomorphic, and you give him a graph, and he with 100% probability gives you the right answer, the only way he could have given you the right answer is if the graphs are not isomorphic, Okay? And so, you know, and this is it. And it turns out, you know, you do this a few times. It's this completely trivial thing. And it's not completely trivial, obviously. But the proof can always be correct only if the two graphs are not isomorphic. And this is a proof of, you know, an interactive proof for graph non-isomorphism. There's also another interesting little thing, which is that you can do this without telling you any fact. You know, he can convince you he's right without actually telling you how to do anything. And so this is also the basis of zero knowledge proofs, if you've ever heard of those. All right. Well, anyway, so based on this, then all of a sudden people said, well, gee, maybe interactive proofs are powerful. And it turned out just a little later that I don't have the right guy. This was based on this, but then Shamir was the one actually proved that IP is equal to P space. And as you recall, my Boolean net problem, this dynamical system that you can just, you know, as long as you can calculate it in polynomial space, it's in P space. And that means it is amenable that any question you can ask about a dynamical system at any time, exponentially long or not, is subject to it can be proven by interactive proof. Okay, and so that's the statement, okay? And so basically it turns out that these guys show that any problem in P space can be written as some polynomial of low degree, right? And so it has not that many variables and low degrees, and the trick is that the coefficients appear to take exponentially long time to compute. We don't know how to compute the coefficients, but it's not a high degree polynomial. But the point is that if a really powerful prover were to tell you what the coefficients were, you could tell that they were the right ones. And in that sense, any question you can ask about this system at any time up to exponentially long times is, you know, verifiable. And it's predictable in the sense that it's described by this polynomial that in principle you can tell is true. Okay, so what else I said? Oh, and then there's this little aside which I'm completely fascinated by, but I have absolutely nothing intelligent to say, so I'm just going to share with you. Is it turns out that calculating quantum dynamics in some reasonably well-defined space is also in P space. So sort of classical mechanics with this continuous space, you know, are in some sense more difficult than quantum mechanics. Okay, and that is basically the reason why this is true is, you know, in quantum evolution it's all unitary, right? So you don't have the orbits diverging exponentially in time. And because of that, it turns out that is sufficient to cause it to be in P space. And in that sense, quantum dynamics are more predictable than classical mechanics. Okay. And so again, the same thing, everything I told you was true for quantum dynamics. I have a feeling I talk too fast, but that's okay. We can have longer breaks. So this is just one thing which I thought you might find interesting. Again, it is, to the extent of predicting earthquakes, probably of limited relevance because, as you see, there's no model. But the statements I told you are true for any model, all right? And in that sense, I think that they're interesting in this question of what is predictability? And there are things that we don't know how to predict, but in principle are predictable, that computer scientists have shown us are predictable, but we don't know how. And again, the discrete dynamical systems, predicting them even at exponentially long times, that can all be done via interactive proof. And again, the question is, does this have any relevance? Okay, so let me just, since I was fast, for which I apologize. So let me just say one thing, which is, it turns out when you do these provers, okay, the prover is not like nature in the sense that you get to tell the prover exactly what it is you want it to know, okay? You know what I mean? That you sort of work out this protocol. And when we're dealing with nature, of course, we don't get to pick exactly what nature tells us. And so I don't know whether there will be a case where this will be directly relevant. But I thought it was interesting, and so that's what I decided to talk about. So I'm on time. Thank you. Okay.
I would say better than on time because it allows for questions and it's an encouragement.
No, but you said 25-minute talk. I did it.
Yes.
I was exact.
Precisely.
Yeah, okay.
Other questions?
Of course, no one may care. But yeah, okay. Oh, good. Okay, someone cared. All right. Yeah.
Starting with Wolfram.
Yes.
Infamous book, A New Kind of Science, where he proposes that everything can be modeled with cellular automata.
Yes.
Which seems a bit parallel to your interest in Bohlian networks, saying that there is an interest in discretizing, because then the system can be predicted over exponential large times. I would like to refer to the paper of Goldens of Israelev and Goldenfeld in Physical Review Letter last year. You might have heard about it. So in Wolfram's book, you have heard about it?
I happen to know exactly what you're talking about. Yeah, so you can ask the question because I know what you're talking about.
This book claims basically that it's impossible to predict nature. The only thing you can do is to develop cellular automata model, run them on a computer or supercomputer and forward, look at patterns, see if the patterns match with reality, let's say with earthquakes, and just hope for the best, because anyway that you cannot really extract any information in physics.
Yeah.
Okay, that is what his claim.
Yeah.
So now the paper by Goldenfeld and Israelev show the following thing. You have only, I think, among the 256 cellular automata in one dimension that Wolfram classified, you have one for which there is an exact mathematical proof, for which the system is of class 3 and class 4, which is irreducibly computationable.
Computationably irreducible,
meaning that it's totally unpredictable except by running forward. Okay. Now, what they showed in this physical review letter is that this mathematical statement of impossibility of prediction is totally irrelevant.
Right, on long scales.
Why? Because what we're interested in is coarse graining. Yeah. We measure everything at a given scale with no infinite resolution. Mm-hmm. So we look at some resolution. When the coarse grain with this exact real space renormalization group method, the cellular automata, they found that the cellular automata of class 4 were mapped to cellular automata class 1 or class 2, which means either trivially constant or periodic, perfectly predictable.
But
my question to you I don't know any of this rigorous statement on impossibility theorems, be they in irreducible computationability or computational irreducibility or incompleteness theorems, etc., that are of any relevance to the physical sciences.
You will like
so
this.
So can you explain how you think this is relevant
All right,
to our problem?
You missed the point at some level. Okay, so the statement is, you said that you have a dynamical system, all right, and well, the only way to do it is to, and you're absolutely right, when Wolfram talks about his book, that's what he says. Okay, but I want to put Wolfram to the side, because nothing that Wolfram says is mathematically rigorous that I can see. Okay, so, not, I mean, of that type. He says, well, we don't know, we can't predict it. This says is computational. But it is predictable. That's what this says. That it doesn't matter that any problem that can be solved in polynomial space can be described in terms of a polynomial. There is a polynomial you can write down. We don't know how to compute it, but it is a predictor polynomial. I mean, in the sense that it doesn't matter whether or not it's chaotic or not, or computationally complete or whatever. Again, this polynomial does exist and can be verified in polynomial time. Okay, and that's the sense in which it is, proven that that statement of Wolfram's is wrong, even if you're a computer scientist. What he was saying is something else, which is that it's like true that you can sort of map out, individual gates and blah blah blah, and you can make you can sort of simulate a computer using a cellular automaton by picking the initial condition in exactly the right way, et cetera, et cetera. But what I'm saying is, even if you do that, and on long scales it doesn't do anything interesting on long scales, even though on short scales it does. But this is a stronger statement. This is, an arbitrarily complicated model that fits into polynomial space can in principle be predicted in polynomial time. Okay, we don't know how, but it can be. Okay, and in that sense it's sort of very optimistic from the point of view of physics. Okay, and all right. Since I was good before, I'll just give you some idea of like how you can do this compression of exponential time into a polynomial space, because that to me is the most interesting thing. And this was done by like Hartmanis in 1970. I mean, So the point is that we have this picture that if you want to do a dynamical system, you just go like this. You just iterate and you keep going, and you got to wait a long time. But basically, he does sort of a renormalization group transformation on it. He says, well, if I want to know how long it takes in time t, all right, basically what I need to know, is there a configuration that I can get to in time t over 2 that, you know, I can get to this intermediate configuration and get from the intermediate configuration to the end. Okay, and so once you, and then it turns out there are some clever things that have to be done in the meantime, but this is very much in the spirit of what we do in renormalization groups. Okay, and so he says, well, you can take that problem and then ask the same problem over and over again. Okay, and because you're doing this geometric series, you can find out where you got to an exponentially long time in just a polynomial number of steps. Because you go 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, et cetera. Okay? And so that's what, and again, there's a lot more to it than that. But it really is the exact opposite of what Wolfram is saying. He's saying the only way you can do it is to, you know, just write down a bunch of models and simulate them. And this is saying the exact opposite. That was why I was jumping up and down. Because that's the whole point, is that even taking Wolfram on his own terms, the computer scientists have proven that he's overly pessimistic, and that it doesn't matter what model you write down, there is an essential sense in which it can be predicted. And that's why I think it's interesting for us. All right, sorry to go on. All right, oh, but I got people ranting. Good. Yeah, not just me.
In what sense is this IP really related to physical predictability, seeing as it relies on the notion of a verifier rather than the notion of actually being able to predict something actively?
I wish I knew the answer to your question. Okay. But the reason why I say it's not entirely without relevance is the fact that, again, in principle, there is a polynomial that, you know, is, again, we don't know how to calculate the coefficients, but if we could, it's a polynomial of polynomial size that contains the information. And in that sense, it's relevant. Of course, this tells you it gives you absolutely no idea of how to find out, you know, how to compute what that polynomial is, except by doing exponentially many operations. You know what I mean? We don't know how to calculate it, but the fact that in principle that polynomial exists, I think, is interesting. You may not. Okay, but yeah, but there's only a half hour of your life. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. You show that it's more optimistic because then even, I mean, things that were characterized as computationally reducible with this IP approach, which combines many different scales, I would say, in this way, makes it actually predictable polynomially. But again, my remark is that we don't care about predicting all the fine details. We are just interested in cross-graining, and so it changed completely the class of problems. That's what makes all this irrelevant, actually, because in physics, we are so far, in geophysics and earthquake, we are so far from having all the details is only cross-graining. Yeah. So new approach.
Yeah. Well, your point is well taken. But again, I find it remarkable that even with a bar this high, there's something you can do. Which again, I didn't say I was solving anything. I said you were going to say something, Mark, or I wiped you out.
Well, I guess. So this would let me predict what would happen at a particular time exponentially far in the future, but if I wanted to be able to say average over a lot of times around that time, say half of the exponential time I wanted to find the average over, that would still grow exponentially, presumably, with the time. So say I want to go know the average from t over 2 to t of some quantity.
Oh, no, that's
some
okay.
Ensemble.
No, because here, you're doing, so let's be stupid. I mean, the only
but
way I know how to...
But for each time, I would have a polynomial process, and I need to know the answer at exponentially many times.
No, the question is what the space is. See, that's the trick. So if you're just doing an average, but then once you do the average, okay. So the thing is, you have the thing that you want to do the average of. So you keep track of the average, and then you keep track of how... Right. But you keep track of the average of the, you know, so you pick your starting time. And then you have sort of your average bin, and you got to keep track of how many things you've done. But that just takes, you know, that doesn't, you know, it exponentially many, an exponentially long time can be handled with polynomially many bits. Okay, so you just keep the average. Okay, at every step, you just add to the average. Okay, which takes polynomially, it only takes polynomial space, and then you just go step by step, adding to your average, throwing away configurations, and you can take an average over as long a time as you want. Again, up to exponentially long times. No, but time is fine. It's only because that's the space is remarkable. But okay, so again, here's the classic example. All right, so they have this thing, and they say, well, all right, here's this thing, and what I want to do is I have, in terms of the Boolean net, just okay. You want to know whether the total number of ones and zeros in the whole evolution is even or odd, okay? Which is, you know, a simple, stupid thing. So you just say, well, it's even in this step, so it's even, and then it's odd in this step, and the total is odd. And again, you can, as long as you can throw away the old information, and just keep track of whatever it is you're keeping track of, and that result is polynomial in space, which it has to be because, you know, you set it up that it's polynomial in space. That's the point, that as long as you can discard what happened at long times previous, you can still do it in polynomial space. And as long as you can do it in polynomial space, the argument goes through. So any question that can that requires polynomial space can be verified in polynomial time. And again, I didn't make this up. I just find it remarkable. But that's the statement. You're not looking convinced.
Well, we're going to continue this later. Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much, Susan.
Okay.